What is up, Hockey IQ listeners? I'm here to chat about our newest sponsor, Sensarena. Your brain is one of the most important parts of your body. Why not invest in a tool that allows you to train it? With Sensarena, athletes can gain a competitive edge using VR training. Players are able to go through a scenario thousands of times without having to step foot on the ice. No more waiting around for puck touches or perfect scenarios. Sensarena can enhance reaction time, decision-making, and multitasking abilities, making you the next MVP. I mean, if the LA Kings are using it, it's got to be good. With our promo code HockeyIQ, you receive $50 off an annual plan purchase. Head on over to sensarena.com to check it all out.
On the podcast today, we bring on Sean Skinner. A little bit of a legend for me as I was growing up. I remember being in the back of my parents' van and watching Sean's DVDs on stick handling and skating and everything. So I'm really excited to bring you on here, Sean.
Wow. Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. I feel like you're the OG, as they call it, the original guy with all of the skills.
The people are like, yeah. My 4-year-old daughter watches you all the time. Dribble, dribble, fake wide. Dribble, dribble, fake wide.
Yeah, a lot of fun and definitely gave me the – I was known for my hands. So I would say you're the reason why. So,
wow, what an honor. Yeah, cool.
Yeah, let's start with some background. How did you get into skills and being probably one of the first, if not like the only back in the day of ones putting out content to the world?
So I grew up in Detroit, suburb of Detroit. I was a player. I wasn't so good. Matter of fact, when I started, I was the worst kid on the ice. And my father would send me to summer hockey school. And I don't mean like just like a camp. I remember sitting down playing basketball with him, and he sat me down and he goes, you want to go to camp? I'm like, sure. So camp for my father meant one camp was 4 hours a day, and he signed me up for two. So I went for 8 hours a day. And then he signed me up for 6 to 8 weeks. And that was for like 10 years. So every summer I would go play hockey all summer. And then I would come back to the team, be like, Skinner, what'd you do with your kid? Oh my God, he's so much better than last year. And then every summer, I would get a year's worth of hockey in one summer season and come back. So I was doubling up on everybody. And I was a skilled player like you. And then when I finished, I went into coaching. I was running camps as a player. And then that was the only thing I knew to make money.
So what gave you the push then to go from I'm just doing these camps into I'm going to produce? Like nowadays, it's really easy for people to grab an iPhone, post it online.
This content is really cool. I'll tell you, I knew a lot, but I didn't know everything about hockey. So I'm going into this profession. I'm starting to coach, and I found out there were videos and DVDs. I never grew up with anything like that as a player. I never had private lessons. I didn't have any of this. And so they gave me some videos, and I was like a sponge. I soaked it up, and then I got more. And then I got some from Sweden and some from Finland and some from Russia. And I just started a collection, like a personal library. And I started watching the videos. I mean, like when I made the skating DVD series, there were only 60 videos combined in worldwide for instruction on skating total. If you want to make a golf video, there's 8,000 golf videos. If you watched one a day, you couldn't watch them all in 5 years, you know? I watched them all, and I watched a few in the beginning, and they were like 30 minutes long, 20 minutes long. And they were like, crossovers are an integral part of the game and should be used when crossing over. I'm like, that's it? Like, what about the technique? What about how to do it? What about 10 drills, you know? And so I just started collecting and putting it together. And so I can almost tell you from the get-go, I had this desire to make a video because what I saw, I thought I knew more. I didn't think I knew everything, but I was like, so then I started collecting. And I tried a few whacks at it. I had a high school senior make a project for me. I moved to another city. I had a TV station do it for me. And finally, I said, I don't know anything. I don't know more about anything else than this. I'm going to put all my money into professionally hiring a company and doing it. And so that Stick Yelling DVD series was the first one we made on VHS, 1998. And that one was an incredible success. Like it lifted me all over the world.
Yeah, and you've been a well-traveled man. Now you're picking up coffee that you can't get anywhere other than in Russia. So clearly you've been around. I'm curious what that's been like traveling the world doing hockey for a living, and just maybe what are some of the differences culturally that feed into how hockey is played in different countries.
Amazing experiences. I pinch myself every morning, like, am I awake? Am I really living this life? I think now I've worked in more countries than any other coach in the world. And I don't mean like, so there's coaches that coach a team and they get to go to another country because, you know, they're sent from their country. Like the Russians play in, let's say, the World Championships, and then they go to the World Championship, the coach team. I mean, invited from other countries to come teach in their country. So there's like 68 countries with hockey in the world, and I've taught in like 48 of them. And just some amazing stories. I'll share some unique things, like, you know, in China, you have to take your slippers, you have to take your shoes off before you go in the house. So we're in China, and they have a 10,000 seat arena. They have slippers for everybody out in the middle of China, because that's the custom. And everyone that comes for the arena. And then it came to dry land. And we're in the weight room doing squats and doing plyometric jumps and all this stuff. And we had to take our shoes off, because inside you don't wear your shoes. A little dangerous.
A little dangerous. Yes, putting it lightly there.
So you got warm-ups for the hockey all around the world. Everyone, like, let's say they do soccer, right? It's just common. They all the Europeans do it. Maybe you'll see a few people in America skip a rope, or we might dribble a golf ball or something like that. That's because we copy Sweden. What do they do? I'm in China, and I come in, and the kids are playing ping pong. Why not? Chinese ping pong. And the other time it was badminton, Chinese badminton. And I used to always make these jokes. I was like, if you're not going to play hockey, right, go play badminton or something like that. And here they are playing badminton.
That's funny. And we had Ted Soikkonen on one podcast, and he was mentioning in Russia that the parents are not allowed to watch practice at many of the clubs. It's just fascinating how it's different in all these countries. And like you said, with the badminton story, you know, you think about it one way in this country and maybe that's accepted somewhere else.
Yeah. I walked in, I was like, what are you guys doing? Badminton. But check this out. In Russia, you can't coach the four-year-olds without a four-year degree. You have to have a degree in coaching. You have to have a coaching card. So coaches in Russia are highly trained, not just in skills, tactics, systems, psychology, dry land. I'll tell you something funny. I was speaking at the World Championships in Europe, and the way the World Championships work is they go to a different country every year, and then each country sends a delegate. So I'm sitting at a table with representatives from like 10 different countries. I said to the guy next to me, I go, who does your power skating for you? Nobody answers. I'm like, why won't they answer? Who does their power skating? And the guy next to me leans over and he goes, what's power skating? And I'm like, you know, the skating for hockey. And they all look at me and they're like, well, the coach does. Who else would teach that? I'm like, oh, well, see, in America, we got father coaches who don't know enough about hockey, so they got to hire a specialist to come in to teach skating. But in these other countries, no, the coach is trained in, highly trained, so parents don't say boo, right? It's like, can't question the coach.
Yeah, it's fascinating how that works. And I'm curious, it seems like with you and Ted Soyken and a few others, North American coaches are making it over to Europe and around the world and having great success with it. I'm curious why you think that, you know, they send over coaches, we send over coaches, but it seems like more coaches stick going from North America to elsewhere rather than elsewhere to North America. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. You know, language is a big, big thing. The Russians are really so skilled. It's an easy case. You could go back and look at the NHL has the individual skill awards. So every year you'd look at the Russian and the import players, and they would win 75% of the individual skill awards, and they only represented like 13% of the NHL. Like the top player on almost every team, it could be a Russian or an import player or something like that. So they focus on skill training. And problem is with the language. Look at Seattle came out this year with the new pro team, right? They publicly came out and said, we will not take a Russian. Generally, when I travel around the world, I go to France. Okay, so you go into Starbucks and it's in French and English. You go into Germany, it's in Deutsch and English. And you go into Russian, and it's in Russian. And you turn on the TV, and it's only Russian. Russia's massive. Canada fits inside Russia three times. They don't believe they need anything else or another language or anything. They're Russian. Superpower. We think we're the only ones. There's other people that think that they're the only ones. And so it's hard to deal with that language. But when you go over there and train them, the kids are so good. The kids are so serious. The first time I was teaching in Moscow for CSKA, it's a Russian Red Army team. I do this all over the world and I'm teaching. And you know, when you do something for rote, it's easy. So we're kind of like laughing, we're smiling, we're joking, we're coming down the ice, we're stick healing, la da 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 da, you know. And the general manager comes down and the president comes down and the coach, Skinner, come over here. I'm like, yeah, what? He goes, this is Russia. In Russia, hockey is serious. There's no smiling, there's no laughing. Get back to work. I was like, yavo, right, okay. And I had kids this year in New Jersey. I was doing a session and they were goofing off. And this was AAA kids. So I stopped the class. I wasted on ice time to tell them this story. And so that they would then practice seriously like the other Russians, like the competitors. And you know what the kid's response was? This kid in the back goes, hey, Coach Skinner, you want to hear a joke? I was like, what? A joke? I'm telling you that we got to practice seriously here. You're going to tell me a joke? Why don't we tell jokes on the ice? Because you could crack it up.
Oh, like, man.
Oh, my God. You guys. This is exactly why we want to go to Russia and work with the kids. They're focused, ready to train.
That's hilarious. That's really good.
There's another story I say is that when an American child comes to the bench, the mom runs over the door. Oh, son. Are you thirsty? Are you tired? Would you like to sit down? He thinks a second. Yes, I'm thirsty. Go get me a Coke. I'm going to sit down, you know. And then when a Russian mom comes to the boards, the kid's trying to get off the ice, says, are you having fun out there? Stay out there. I'll be back in a couple hours. It's like what the parent says to the kid registers in the mind. And then they act out accordingly. Like, you don't have a choice. Stay on the ice. Keep practicing. I'll be back.
That's good. And talking about Russia, there's a lot of people with Anatoly Tarasov. mm-hmm. who was a motivating factor and truly changed the game worldwide. It seems like Russia maybe has gone away a little bit from his principles, but there's still so many great elements to be learned from him. I'm curious if we could dive into him and his influence. And I know you've got a great story about off-ice training as well.
Yeah, you got to read. Everyone in hockey needs to read this book. It's called Road to Mount Olympus. It's only like 70 pages. This is like a pamphlet, not even a book. It's the history of him. So interesting thing is, you know, Russian's first competition, international competition, 1948. They were into dance and ballet. They weren't into ice hockey. They came in the 60s. Tarasov was the coach. He didn't copy anybody else. He didn't copy the Canadians or the Americans or the Europeans. He started his own, like, plays, his own game. So he comes in the 60s, and the book describes this. For 3 years, he wins the champions, every Olympics and every world championships for 10 years. From 1960 to, like, 72, okay? He says after 3 years, he goes, well, they know my systems. I have to change it. He changes his hockey system, and he plays another way for 3 years. And he says, oh, they know my system. I got to change again. He does this three times. Generally, hockey has never changed in 50 to 70 years. One guy goes in, forechecks, second guy backs him up, you know, 2-1-2-2, 2-1-2. It's like we play in the same way. Also, he said it's a team. There should be no individual better than the whole team. So when they came to the first world championships and they won, they were hard pressed to pick who was the best. And he talks about how picking who was the best, the MVP, actually started to ruin everything. Because it promoted one player over another. And he didn't want that. He wanted it's a team game. Everybody to be the same. Maybe that's a Russian influence there. But he wanted to prove to everybody one time, you mentioned this interesting study. He wanted to prove how important dry land training was. In the 70s, he took two Red Army teams of equal ability. They were playing each other. One would win 4-3. The other win 4-3. Lou Vero actually told me this from USA Hockey, one of our Olympic coaches, and he was personal friends with Tarasov. I never got a chance to meet him. He said, I'm going to take one team and do only dry land training, and the other team's going to do only on ice training. So for 8 weeks, he did only dry land. The other team did on ice, and he got 1 2-hour on ice practice before they played. And the dry land team beat him like by eight points. So this was an amazing demonstration. Everybody was convinced. And then American picked up dry land, America, Canada. And what do? Weightlifting at first. Even USA Hockey, when we started that Ann Arbor Training Center, the first thing we had in there was a boxing ring and this. And after many interchanges with the European hockey and everything, they took out the boxing ring. They put in a dry land skills training area for skills. And eventually we switched, and weight training turned into core training and strength training, performance-based training and skill training. So I saw some amazing teaching in Czech Republic where their dry land training consists of tactics. They would take a team handball and they would go through 2-on-1s and 2-on-2s and 3-on-2s and positional plays, all dry land. Because it's a free, open environment where you can teach, you can make a long explanation, no cost. You get on the ice and then you just call out what we learned in dry land. And fantastic stuff to pick up when you go around the world like that.
That's fascinating. And the Czechs, I really like that, how they're actually teaching tactics off ice, not just skills. Both are important. You got to be able to execute it, but you need to be able to think it first. So that's excellent.
I saw one time where they were not only working on 2-on-1s, but they decided to I think actually this comes from Tarasov. They have guys on their shoulders. So they're working leg strength. Guys on their shoulder, passing the ball back and forth to another guy on his shoulder. And the defenseman's going backwards with a guy on his shoulder trying to play defense.
I've definitely seen a picture of Tarasov doing that in training. And then he would do a lot of the wheelbarrows. And
in 1960, the Russians, 72, but it was the 60s they were training. They were jumping rope while stick handling and dribbling. And our guys were worried about smoking and drinking, you know. And there's a paper that circulated where the Toronto Maple Leafs sent out a letter for preseason training camp where it says, "I hope you guys come in shape this summer because we're really going to fight for these positions, and you need to be able to do like 10 push-ups." It was like, what? And don't forget to bring your golf clubs, because remember, we're going to be playing some golf too at these tryouts.
Change times. That's what we have now. Let's change times. There's no such thing as a true off season where you can just do whatever you want, whenever you want, until hockey season rolls around. Youth, we should definitely have that happening, but not at the NHL.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I'm curious to dive in. You've got this huge knowledge base in your head around stick handling and skating. I'm wondering if we can get some teaching or coaching hacks to help players pick up some serious talent, techniques, whatever, some key elements. So maybe we start with if you have any coaching and teaching hacks. And if, you know, after that, we can maybe dive into
the key elements. So there's a quote that I always had. One is, it's perfect practice makes perfect. It's not practice. Coming out for 8 hours doing it wrong is going to make it wrong. Better that you come out for 1 hour and do it correctly first. That's the first thing. We always said with the videos, you know, seeing it once is better than hearing it 1,000 times. So it's so great to see it done properly, or to even see yourself. Film yourself and look at what you look like. Even your parents nowadays can film a shift. And I remember the first time I saw myself skate, I was like, oh, standing there looking like that. That wasn't fighting for the puck. And real quick, you don't even need someone to say correction. That's a whole nother level. You can just, you watch it yourself, because you watch NHL and you see the guy flying for 30 seconds here and there and everywhere and getting off the ice fast. And you're like, oh, okay, I got to skate like that. So that's the other thing. I have this, I'm a skills coach, and I actually use this not only for skills, but tactics and systems. I have what's called the rule of tens. And I think this is the key in my personal teaching. But I say, you don't own anything. You can't really do it until you can do it 10 times without a mistake. And what does that mean? So these kids, they go like this. They go, "Dad, pick a corner." You're shooting, right? And they've been practicing all day and they want to show off their shooting. And they go like, "Okay, shoot the lower left." "No, no, 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 Dad. I said, hey, pick a corner." "Lower right." "No, no, 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 Dad, pick a corner. I want to show you my upper right. Watch this." Boom. And they try to shoot it. And so they want to show like one upper corner, of course. But I say to a kid like, "Okay, shoot to the upper right 10 times in a row, not all over the net." And they shoot. And so they get like 3 out of 10. And I'll say, or if I'm doing tactics, even like a 2-on-1, I'll do it 10 times with the team without them knowing the first time. And then I'll blow the whistle and call them in and I'll say, "Okay, you don't know it, but we just did that 10 times and they do it right 3 out of 10 times. And I say to them, "You did it right 3 out of 10 times. Can some smart guy here give me a percentage?" "Oh, yeah, right away. That 30%. I go, "Oh, very good, good. Now, can you give me a grade in school for that?" "Oh, let's see. That's an F." I said, "No, no, that's not an F. An F is 60%. I wish you were at 60%. Then I would have something to work with here. But you're not. You're at 30%. So I don't have anything to work it with at all. Let's see if we can get up to 60%. But what is 60%? 60% is right next to 50%. And 50% is flipping the coin. That is called getting lucky. So why don't we see your 2-on-1? Why don't we see your shot in the game? Because you're only doing 6 out of 10. It is lucky. If you want to perform, if you want to do it to win, you got to be 9 out of 10 or 10 out of 10. Pro basketball player shoots a free throw. 10 out of 10. Because that's why he's a pro basketball player. I have a situation that happened. I think a lot of your clientele's in Ohio. It would be so fitting to tell you this. I did a pro camp where Wierinski was in the camp. And we were stick handling. We were doing some high-end speed training where you had to make 2 fakes on the edge out of control as fast as you could. You had to do it correctly without losing the puck. And take a shot and hit the net. Just hit the net. So again, we did it 10 times. And I went down the line. I asked this kid where he was at. In these pro camps, you have some players that are pros, some that are college, some that are juniors, some aspiring to be pros. So I asked this guy, and he's 3 for 10. Another guy's 5 for 10, 6 for 10. I don't know if we had a guy that was even 6 for 10. And I came up to Wierinski, who was in the front of the line, and I go, "How many times did you do it correct?" And he goes, "Do it correct? I scored every single one of them. Besides, he made 2 moves and the edge out of control. He scored all 10 shots, not even just hit the net." And I looked down the line, everybody, and I said, "See why he's first round draft pick and you guys are not? You need to move from 3 out of 10, 5 out of 10 to 10 out of 10. And then you'll be a pro player."
More practice. A lot of that off ice stuff, right?
Yeah, you can't get enough of that. But how you practice is what I'm trying to say. So whatever you do, do it in sets of 10, give yourself a grade, reevaluate. You know what a practice is? Check this out. I call practices dress rehearsals. You're never practicing. None of these kids are practicing, even AAA team. So you come in for an hour. What do you got? Four lines on that team. A good coach has to do like 7 drills in an hour, right? You got to do like 5 to 7 minutes switch. You got a warm up drill. You got a conclusion drill. You got 5 to 7 drills. So you're going to do 4 chances to do the 2-on-1, 4 chances to do the 1-on-1, 4 chances to do the 3-on-2, 4 chances to do the power play, 4 chances to do the penalty kill, right? You get done. And what have you done? If I told you, okay, tomorrow, get ready for practice. We're going to hammer out the free throw. We're going to really work it. Okay. You're going to take 4 free throws tomorrow. Are you really going to work it? These practices from the highest level at the best coaches become dress rehearsals. You haven't really worked anything. If you want to work it, you're going to do the 2-on-1 10 times. You're going to call everybody in and said, "Hey, you only got it right 3 out of 10 times. Let's do it another 10. Let's do it another 10. Let's get it until we get it 9 out of 10. Let's do that with a skill. Let's do it till we get that perfection. And then we'll get performance."
Yeah, I feel like that's why that off-ice component is so crucial. As coaches, they have an agenda and they've got a whole team. They have to keep it moving a little bit. Meanwhile, off ice, you can really nitpick on the details, take your time, go through all of that and really up the success rate to a level where you're happy with that and able to transfer it onto the ice. So I feel like the key is really going beyond what you're doing with your team and how you practice away from the rink.
That's really well said, because I got to say, I'm going around to all these hockey practices and I see everyone doing all this strength and conditioning. I see these stupid, I'm calling them stupid, quick foot ladders, because these kids can't pass. They can't stick handle. They can't shoot. They can't skate. And we're forcing them to do athletic skills that you're supposed to bring to the sport. That's on your own time. You can't come to practice to do a quick foot ladder. Could you imagine if basketball, you never see quick foot ladder at baseball or basketball. At baseball and basketball, you're doing those skills of that sport. Could you imagine if they did not shoot free throws for practice and did a quick foot ladder instead? if in baseball they took out the pitching mounds and the batting cages and did quick foot ladders instead. That's what we're doing in ice hockey. That strength coach is using his skill. He needs to make money, so he sold you. The coach doesn't know what skills or tactics to do, so he's doing quick foot ladders. And these kids can't pass, shoot, stick handle, skate, let alone maybe tactics. That's stuff that they need to do with the team and individual. And the athletic skill stuff you do on your own, you bring to the sport.
So what do you think holds players back from improving and really jumping up their talent level from whatever level they are to where they want to be?
Now I think we're really seeing an explosion. All these home practice units, practice rinks, dry land training, skills, camps, even coaches. Coaches know more now, and they're doing better jobs. So they're even doing their own camps. And we've got some great high-level teams, even kids that are excelling from Florida and California and Texas. So I think it's the other way around. I think people are excelling now. One thing I thought was really interesting, when we had the Olympics, 94 or 2004, the Summer Olympics, were in, was it Atlanta, something like that? Anyways, USA, we ran ads across the TV. It said, America, we don't send our athletes to the Olympics. You do. And it was so true. So what happens in these foreign countries? As long as you play well, the government pays for you. The kids in Russia don't pay for hockey. The government pays for hockey. They have an adult hockey league, adults playing rec league. Putin pays for everyone to play. And they complain. People still complain. I don't like my hotel. I don't like my, but it's for free. And we pay for everything. So what can you do? If you look at that, America, we don't send our athletes to Olympics. You do. If you're an elite gymnast, you can go out and go train with Beta Caroli. You can go get as many lessons, as many training sessions as you want. You can become hockey. You can go to every hockey school. You can go move to this AAA club. You can go play. And everything you can afford to do, so you can make it. And that's what we find. Highly skilled kids coming out of California that don't think the game right because they've done every skills camp in the world, but they haven't done training like in tactics and systems.
Sounds like they need the Hockey IQ podcast and Hockey IQ newsletters. That's what I'm hearing from that. Absolutely. And you know, I'm curious. So it's definitely different in the world and how things are funded in different systems. You got your team-based, club-based, grassroots, whatever you want to call it. I'm curious. I feel like this has definitely got to be an across-the-board question between the parent push and the player desire and how that comes in.
Yeah. I'm going to answer that question. I just had another thought. It's just good to share right now when we were talking about the different countries. So I want to say another thing about Canada and US. You know, like we say, we can afford, we can pay for it. We can get as good as we want, as much as we pay ourselves. So check this out. If you want to become a better coach, you have to go study. You have to go learn on your own. You have to pay for the video. You have to pay for the class. You have to pay for the instruction. So so the Swedish Hockey Federation called me and they wanted me to do come and speak for them at the World Championships on skating. And I said to them, I go, you mean stick handling, right? They go, no, skating. I'm like, sure, right. Okay, stick handling. I did skating and stick handling my whole life, but at that time I had made the stick handling DVD series and so I was known more as a stick handling coach, but they said, no, we researched the whole world around. You're the guy for skating. I'm like, okay. 6 months went by. They're like, how's the lecture going? Are you getting ready? I'm like, yeah. And I go, you mean a stick handling, right? They go, no, skating. A couple of weeks before they called and like, you got the ticket and everything. And I'm like, stick handling, right? They go, no, skating. So I went there and did it. They loved the presentation and they hired me. I worked for the Swedish Federation for like 3 years. They found a wealthy person to fund the project to make instructional DVDs for every coach and every player in the country. So it came over there. We shot the videos and they translated all into Swedish. And then they gave a DVD to every single player and coach in the country. No one had to go find it. No one had to buy it. They said, look, we want to increase our coaches and increase our players. So we're going to pay for it. We're going to do it. Just a whole different idea of how to take care of everybody versus over here, you got to do it your own. Okay, let's come back to your question. Want to state it again?
Yeah, where we're going between the parent push and kind of the player pull and how that interacts and how you see that unfolding in the industry or the game.
I used to always say like this, these parents are, they think they're in control, like a gambler. Oh, I figured out how to win. Let me go back to the money machine and get some more money out until eventually they're going to the pawn shop and they're pawning everything and they keep going back and they keep spending money, gambling. And the parents the same way. Oh, if I get my kid with this camp, if I get my kid on this team, he will make it. If I get my kid here, you know, and I push him, I make him play here. If I train him all the way in the car on the way to the game and on the way home, you know, I'll make him this thing. And I think the kid has to buy into it himself.
It's 8 o'clock.
So you see, at a younger age, you have to train kids. You have to teach them and you have to force them. And then as you go through it, as they get older, you have to release and they have to own it themselves and they have to do it themselves. So I say to the parent that's working with a young child, says, I have a 6-year-old. How long can I practice with them? And, you know, like a young child has, let's say, a 15-minute attention span. And I say to him, 10 minutes. Like, what do you mean? I go, you can train him for 10 minutes because he's interested. He wants to do it. And you take him to 16 minutes and he cries and you've wasted everything. But you take him to 10 minutes and you say, oh, we're done. We got to stop. No. I want to keep going. Okay, you can keep going if you want to on your own, but I got to go right now. The kid stays for 4 more minutes, practice on his own. That 4 minutes turns into 14 more minutes and he trains, he practices. It's just a little switch. You press the kid, the child, the player too much. It becomes a painful and awful situation. You have to drive too far. You have to skate too much and they don't own it and want it themselves. So it's a key of motivating them to keep them on the edge of, oh, you want to do this? Okay, we'll go. You want to train more? Okay, I'll stay and watch. But if you keep forcing them, then they don't want to do it. You're forcing them.
It's fascinating how you're ending at the most excitement. Like you're going out at the top, which encourages the child to want to do more. Like, no, I don't want to stop quite yet. I think that's a fascinating concept that I have yet to hear from someone else.
Yeah. Makes it a lot of fun.
Absolutely. I feel like that might be the same thing with a lot of things in life where you want to maybe end a little bit early rather than a little bit late.
Yeah. If you do something and you're not succeeding at it, you're not going to want to keep doing that.
Not at all. So The last piece I want to touch on is the skating video. So you produced the Ultimate Hockey Skating DVD series, which was, I want to say, ridiculously long, but extremely comprehensive given the time.
How long? 18 and a half hours. 10 DVDs, 18 and a half hours. Each DVD is 2 hours long.
I hope it's on a streaming platform these days. It is. I don't even think DVDs DVD players exist unless you got it 5 years ago.
These kids come up to me, they go, "Coach Skinner, what's a DVD?"
I said, all right. My new computers don't even have DVD readers, yeah, CD readers. Like, I've got clients give me estate documents, and I'm like, I'm going to have to find something to rip this off of because we don't have it here at the office.
Even myself, I really don't have DVDs anymore. They're all VODs, video on demands. But the important thing is the instruction. And what I did, nothing rocket science. I paid attention in school. They taught us how to write a research paper. And I saw all these videos, all these DVDs, all these books, all these articles. And I did a research paper. As a matter of fact, unlike most videos and DVDs, I put a bibliography in the DVD. I cited all the sources that I took from, and I collected it all into one place. So the DVDs are organized in chapters, 15 to 20 minutes at a time, 8 chapters per DVD, and all those exercises in a progression per chapter. I learned so much myself making the DVD series. Even I was running a practice a couple years ago, and I had to go back and watch my own DVD to remember what to teach. And I'm watching myself on the screen, and I'm like, what? What is he saying? I know that? I didn't even remember that I said that. I was taking notes for myself. I was like, that was well researched. And can't remember all this stuff. I made over 20 DVDs. Like, it's a lot of material. But it's out there if someone wants to practice, if someone wants to coach. I took everything from all over the world. I cited where it came from. I cited the website, the equipment, where it was made, how to get it, who's teaching it. And then I would show, like, okay, here's the, I call it the Russian way or the Rocky way, you know, Hollywood. We got the boxing movies, and Rocky. So it tells you that, America does everything by science. I mean, by training with rocks, Rocky. And the Russians, they got drugs and science, and they got computer machines and their training. And actually, I can tell you from the experience of what I've seen, it's the other way around. We have the science and the machines. They're the ones stick handling through the forest with rocks instead of real balls or something. Hollywood always lied to us. But the Russian way or the Rocky way. So you can buy the piece of equipment. Slide boards, very important training tool. The top one, probably $350. And we made my first one at home for $30. We went down to Home Depot and bought the Formica counter and the plywood, and we glued it on and put bumpers on. There's always a cheap way and an expensive way to do everything. So you have no excuse. You can always really practice. Just make the equipment on your own or buy it.
So I'm curious, you've done all of this research, you've become an expert, you've traveled around the world. You know, what is a thing or two in skating that you can teach everyone in 30 seconds? Like, what would be maybe like the item? Like, if you're talking on skating, I'm going to definitely touch on this and this.
Yeah. So let's look at what we're all about speed. Our sport is about speed. Everyone wants to skate faster. So let's say I got two players. I got player A that skates faster than player B. I actually want player B maybe instead of player A. Why? Player B accelerates faster than player A. Player A skates faster, but player B accelerates faster. Key in our game is acceleration, stops and starts. We don't have long races for the puck. We have short, quick races from the front of the net to the corner, from the corner out to the blue line. From the blue line in, you know, so it's these short, quick races. It's all about acceleration. And we should really focus there first, starting and stopping, quick agility. Well, I think that's going to be what I'm going to say. There's so many aspects to skating, you know, they say like six aspects. You got forwards, edges and crossovers, backwards, edges and crossovers, long stride or forward skating. You got stops and starts, acceleration. You have agility and tight turns. So you go to a hockey camp, a good skating camp. Let's say you need to work on your pivoting. Well, a good hockey camp is going to do one of these aspects every single day. And then you're going to work on pivoting for 5 minutes on Thursday. But you need 5 days of pivoting because it's not just skating that you need. You need exactly this skating. So it's voluminous. Like it's the biggest. That DVD series, VOD now, it's the largest single production ever done in the history of ice hockey.
It's really pretty massive. I'm curious from all of that study, all of the videos, if like I found that outside edges traditionally are extremely underdeveloped. Have you found any big deficiencies in players?
You know, what I see in the skating department, they got all these things, cross unders instead of crossovers, different ways to describe it. Really, there's two pushes. You cross over, you push with one leg, you push with the leg underneath. I like to say crossover, push under. But one thing I found, I actually researched for 20 years before I made the skating DVD series. I hosted two international skating symposiums where I brought in the top skating coaches, the top strength and conditioning coaches from all over the world. And I just was constantly gathering all this information because I didn't want to produce something where I would say it wrong. And I wanted a video camera to film the player from the front, from the side, from the top. I wanted a computer to analyze it. I wanted a computer to print out why player one was faster than player 10. And phenomenal research that would cost like millions. And finally, I figured out that this skating coach in Vancouver made pro players. And this skating coach in Boston made pro players. And this skating coach in Colorado did it. And each of them were saying something totally different. Every skating coach has their own way. But they all have a progression of exercises. So I found that if you as a skater will study under these trainers and you will learn all the different ways to move, forget about what they're saying because they're all saying something different, including federations. If you take starting, acceleration, how do you start? One place says three short strides. One place says a short, a medium, and long stride. Another country says three long steps. One person says running on the balls of your foot. One person says on the flat of the blade. Another person says you're on your toes. If you actually studied starting, you'd be more confused at the end. Better to not study it. But if you go out and you practice, because we learn by doing, and you learn all the exercises, because usually a pro coach has like 10 to 15 different exercises for each skill set. Then all of a sudden you're starting fast and quickly. And so I found I just have to take these progression of exercises from all over the world, from each skating coach, and put it into a progression. And then I produced it without $1 million of computer research. I did actually find a way to film the hockey player. We put the video camera up on the roof of a NHL arena, and we filmed the player from above, from the side, from the front. We just didn't have the computer spit out the model.
There's, like you said, there's the expensive way and the cheap way, and it's just a matter of desire. So, love hearing that. I just want to end on what you're known for probably the most out there, the stick handling. You know, what are the keys to being a good stick handler? I always remember you got to have that top hand out in front of you and be able to move at any direction at any time.
Really interesting topic in what you said. If you looked at the best players in every sport, okay, the best soccer players, the best basketball players, best hockey players, the best players in each sport are the ones that handle the ball the best. So look at, if you ran through a list of the NHL greats, the best players in ice hockey, the ones who scored the most points, it's by far and large, they're all stick handlers. Gretzky, Lemieux, Yzerman, Messier. Occasionally you get a shooter in there. Let's say like Brett Hall, Chera. Sometimes you get a defenseman that excels at a skill, checking, defensive play. But by and far large, the best players in the history of our game are the stick handlers. Top three paid players on every team are your stick handlers. And the best, you could extrapolate that down to your Bantam team, to your under 12 team, to whatever. So this is a very important skill set. If you want to be the best, it's not the only skill set, because you could be there by tactics or positioning, but very important. And what I saw was that every rink has a skating coach or five. And there were very few stick handling coaches in the world. So I decided to separate myself and just focus on the stick handling. It was a little easier than the hard skating. And, you know, I made these videos and I got hired by Canadian Hockey. Canadian Hockey bought 100 sets. They built 100 skilled training centers all across the country. They had me come in and train the coaches to run each place. I got hired by the Montreal Canadiens, did a preseason training camp in front of 14,000 fans. I got to shoot on Carey Price. We had PK Subban in line. We had the whole deal. And they bought 50 sets, one for every single player and every coach in the organization. The Swedish Hockey Federation had me make DVDs in Sweden. And then I taught in Japan. They translated the DVDs into Japanese. And I taught in Russia. And interesting, because Russia has their own videos, quite a few, all in Russian. And they never translated any DVD in the history of ice hockey. I could pay to do it. Like, I could have told you that, look, I paid to put it into French and I paid to put it into Swedish, but I didn't pay. These countries did. The Russians actually took and translated all of my DVDs into Russian. And I'm actually more famous in Russia than anywhere else, because they said like the same thing you said. I grew up learning to play hockey from your DVDs. So I get asked for autographs all the time in Russia. And I was training there this summer and I was walking down the street and I'm like, I always have this thing. I'm somewhere in the world and no one knows me and no one can find me. And then walking down the street in Moscow and someone goes, Coach Skinner. And I'm like turning my head like, what? Who knows me here? And then the very next week it happened, the same thing happened in St. Petersburg. And I was like, what, really? I'm out in the middle of public. So it was kind of funny. But stick handling, I'm probably known all over the world for it, just because the DVDs went all over the world.
So same thing with the skating. If you had to distill one or two key items into stick handling, what might those be?
So the foundation of stick handling is dribbling, like in basketball. In basketball, it's a rule. You can't go down the court without dribbling the ball. But in ice hockey, we dribble the puck. And by dribbling the puck, short taps of the stick back and forth, then our head comes up and we look around and we see the ice. And we say, nothing will happen on the ice until you see it first. You won't shoot to the right place. You're not even going to know that the person's open to pass to until you see him first. So that the process of dribbling the ball, like in basketball, at first you're like batting it down, and then eventually you get quicker and you're dribbling real low. And then all of a sudden you start looking around while you're dribbling. So in ice hockey, the same thing. You have to be able to dribble that puck until your head can come up and you can look around and you're not even looking at the puck anymore. You're dribbling and you're looking around and then you can see the play. That's really the foundation of all of stick handling. Before we speak about going around people, it's not meant to be end-to-end rush where you skate through the other team. Passing still beats skating and passing still beats stick handling. But you do need enough skill to win that one-on-one battle so you can then forward and pass that puck. And that's where it comes in. I think that's going to be one of the founding parts to the whole stick handling thing. And what I didn't say earlier, I meant to say, is that this is not magic. You know, the one person's born a stick handler, one person's not. It's a learned skill. It's trained. It's movement patterns. And that's part of why I made the video series. Each technique is named. It's a separate technique. And you can practice it over and over. You can get it down. You can be able to do it 10 out of 10 times. And you can be able to do it faster. And then you can do it moving. And this is something that every player can learn to do.
Absolutely. And there's so many techniques that go into it. And you've obviously gone through a lot of them. People can find you not just in rinks these days, but also on Zoom, it sounds like.
Yeah, we're doing Zoom sessions. Funny thing is, now with this younger generation, they're creating new techniques and new moves. And I still have to go and learn the new one, like flip the puck up in the air and spin your stick around 20 times and catch it out of the air. I'm going to make a highlight video where the player is standing in the middle in front of the net and he flips the puck up in the air and he spins the stick around and some guy, 230 pounds, 6'4", comes flying through and checks him right across the ice.
Too funny. But no, I appreciate you coming on here today and taking the time. Before we let you go, please tell the people where they can find you, and I'll link everything in the show notes as well. But it's been an honor and a pleasure.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on the blog. I've got two places you can get me all the time. My website, which is skinnerhockey.com. Also, it's linked to www.stickhandling.com. And then you can get me on Instagram at CoachSkinner12. And thank you so much, Greg. Hope to see you again.
Wonderful. Well, thanks, Sean.
Bye, Greg.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that episode. I know I did. So before we let you go, though, we'd like to remind you to please like our podcast, subscribe to it, give us a follow, and share this with all the hockey people in your life. We really appreciate growing this community, this podcast. Remember, we also have a newsletter, the Hockey IQ newsletter as well. Really excited to continue to grow this. So please help us grow this further by liking, subscribing, following, and sharing with everyone. So appreciate you all. Take care.
That concludes this week's episode. Thanks for joining us here at Hockey IQ. If you haven't already, take a quick moment to hit that subscribe button, give us a thumbs up, and drop a review. If you want to be a great teammate, even recommend us to a friend. You can follow us at Hockey's Arsenal on Twitter and Instagram. Check out the website, hockeysarsenal.com, where you can subscribe to the weekly newsletter. You won't regret it. Catch you beauts here next week for a brand new episode.